On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. 2 decades ago, new research and new diagnostic tools led to a sharp rise in the number of children diagnosed with autism. The surprising prevalence of this developmental brain disorder, affecting an estimated 1 in 68 children born in the United States, sparked a wave of special programs designed to help autistic children achieve their full potential. But now, as these children have grown into adults, programs to help them live their lives with purpose and dignity are few and far between. This morning, producer Rob Sivek reports on some local efforts to address the unique challenges of adults with autism. Then theater critic Jay Wynn Russick reviews the Baltimore Playwrights Festival production of Crash and Burn, PA, and I'll talk with Frederick author Suzanne Feldman about her new novel, Absalom's Daughters, about race and self-discovery in the American South. First, the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We begin today with a look at some efforts here in Baltimore to identify, assist, and serve a population that was barely recognized even just a few decades ago, adults with autism. Senior producer Rob Sivek has the story.
Autism spectrum disorder. It's a familiar term at the heart of a growing national conversation about a still poorly understood brain development condition and about how society can move to better understand, embrace, and support people who are born with it and who live their lives on the spectrum. Autism's impact varies among individuals across a wide range or spectrum, but it's typically marked by difficulties with social interactions, abnormal communication, and repetitive or unusual behaviors. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's most recent data estimates that at least 1 in 68 children in the United States, between 1 and 2% of the population, are born with the disorder, with boys 5 times more likely than girls to have it. Just a few decades ago, new research and new diagnostic tools created a kind of boom in public awareness of autistic children. Today's autistic birth rate estimates are 20 times what they were in the 1980s. Some have called it an epidemic of discovery. And all those newly diagnosed autistic children have now grown to be adults with autism, facing a world ill-prepared to support and accommodate them. Over the past 15 years, there have been increased efforts by parents of autistic children, medical research centers, and universities to focus on the unique needs and challenges facing autistic adults. One of the country's leading experts in autism, Dr. Danielle Fallon, heads the Wendy Clagg Center for Autism and Developmental Disabilities at the Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. In a conversation we had a few months ago here on Maryland Morning, Fallon recalled how the Wendy Clagg Center itself was born just 10 years ago to address a long list of unanswered questions about this expanding population of adults with autism.
The dean of our school, Mike Clegg, his late wife, Wendy, is who our center is named after, the Wendy Clagg Center for Autism and Developmental Disabilities, and they have an adult daughter on the autism spectrum. And so the question that they faced for many years raising their daughter was, what will happen when she becomes an adult? You know, what do we know? What is known about the services available? What will happen as you develop social life as an adult? Can you be employed? All of these kinds of questions. And they are tough questions to answer. Most of the field has been focused on how to provide services for children. And so when we move to this, you know, burgeoning set of adults who will be on the autism spectrum, we don't have as good a data. We just don't know as much about how many adults are out here living with autism spectrum disorder, how they're doing health-wise, how they're doing in terms of, are they living independently or in an assisted facility? Are they employed or not? And so we would love to have better information about that at the local level and certainly at the state and national level.
Fallon says one of the earliest local efforts came around 2003 from a coalition of health professionals and parents with autistic children who were asking those tough questions about adult autism.
Baltimore City has an organization called Itinerus that really was a grassroots effort among families who were facing the same kinds of questions. And they now do help families and clients set up assisted day programs, employment opportunities, sometimes help with assisted living kinds of arrangements. And it's that kind of effort that is needed. And while there are also public entities that can handle that through disability services, it is a really both understudied and probably unmet need that we all have to pay attention to.
One of Itinerus's founding and still active board members is Zosha Zaks, a certified rehabilitation counselor who was in his 30s when he first learned he has autism. He says being on the spectrum allows him to understand the challenges facing autistic adults, a special insight that's been of great value to his work, not only with the nonprofit Itinerus, but in his full-time job as manager of education and programs at the Hussman Center for Adults with Autism, part of the Institute for Well-Being within Towson University's College of Health Professions. Zaks oversees not only the students who come to the Hussman Center to gain clinical experience with autism, but also the autistic adult participants who enroll in the fee-for-service Hussman Center's many social and therapeutic programs. During a visit to the center, I asked Zaks to describe the biggest challenges facing autistic adults.
Well, I'll answer that two ways. The first way is sort of the classic way. You know, if you look at how autism is defined, it's challenges, for example, in social communication. Oftentimes, adults on the spectrum will have an area of expertise or special interest. If you talk to self-advocates, for example, at the Honestly Autism Day conference in April, here in Baltimore, I moderated a panel of adults on the autism spectrum, and if you listened to the content when they were describing their challenges, all of them said the challenge is really the barriers in society. They may be different, they may have some diversities. All human beings, I think, are diverse and have some things they're working on and some other things that they're really good at, and what adults on the spectrum consistently find or identify as the issue is when they don't have opportunities to contribute. Mm-hmm. Or when people, you know, only seek to understand them through this lens and don't try to get to know them as whole people.
I was looking for, I guess, friends and making new friends. Other than that, I was just playing Xbox and not really working.
That's Noah Plotkin, a 21-year-old on the autism spectrum, who first connected with the Hussman Center last year.
Yeah, I was living at home playing Xbox for about like 9 hours, and I was just thinking to myself, you know, this is not fun. I'm talking to people around the world, but not actually face-to-face with people, having conversations. So I went over here, and I've been having a lot of friends.
Plotkin says he was encouraged to sign up for one of the Hussman Center's work exploration programs, leading a group of other adults on the spectrum on a campus job that tapped into Plotkin's strengths.
The Hussman Center had a program where we would drive over to the Towson University. We would clean, disassemble, and I guess put the computers back together because they were gonna like donate them to like other schools. And my computer skills are sort of above, not kind of like way over the above like Bill Gates, more like kind of above average, sort of like a tech person. And most of the other students there that were from the Hussman Center needed a little bit of help. And since I had a little bit more knowledge than some people, I, you know, mm-hmm. did the step by step. I didn't do it for them. I let them kind of do it on their own. And it's mm-hmm.
But you were there to guide them.
Oh, yes. I was definitely there to guide them.
Zosha Zaks says that for a young man who'd had trouble finding and keeping jobs since graduating from high school, leading the computer team was a powerful confidence builder.
And he just came out of that experience beaming. He was like, oh, I can do something. Like, how I work is of benefit to some jobs. Mm-hmm. It's about finding my niche, you know. I think we see the social communication, the knowledge and awareness of yourself, and also just adjusting to what it means to be a worker.
Besides its work exploration programs, the Hussman Center runs a wide range of pay-for-service programs and activities for its autistic adult participants, From physical training in a well-equipped and instructor-staffed fitness center to dance, music, and art classes, and importantly, social groups for both men and women that meet at the center on a regular basis. Chris Hicks is a 33-year-old with Asperger's who's been coming to the Hussman Center for 5 years.
We have a social group. We've been doing it every other Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So we just usually engage in a handful of activities, and then we also do some things for like customs to things about autism, and we bring snacks, and some store-bought, and then we show movies, and then playing games, singing songs, and things of that nature.
First, what we're going to do is we're going to do a little dancing. We're going to get you moving and grooving.
Music is a great tool because the participants find commonalities of, you know, oh, I like this type of music too.
That's Ashley Ciccone, a certified music therapist on the Hussman Center staff. She's leading a group of 8 autistic adults in the final music class of the year with a warm-up round of circle dancing. Each dancer ends their turn in the center by pointing to another in the group to take their place.
The first song is by James Brown.
Oh, all right.
I feel good.
If I were to go up to a person and have a conversation, that in of itself could be deemed to them threatening or stressful, whereas if I just turn on a favorite song of theirs and then ask them to talk about that song or do something within that song, all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, I can do that.
The Hussman Center's Zosha Zaks says the music and art classes, the fitness training, the social groups, and especially the work exploration programs have a single overarching goal.
It's about giving people an opportunity to demonstrate what they can do. A lot of people on the spectrum may not be able to demonstrate what they can do in the typical way. So it's finding out how to give them a chance to demonstrate. You know, here they can have time to practice workplace social communication skills, to find out what they might be good at, to find out what they might like to do, but also to find ways that they can show people that they're capable. We really want to find places that these adults can contribute, and that's why it's not, you know, how significantly impacted are you, or can you talk or not talk? It's what can you contribute, and we want to find that place because that's where adults find their dignity.
Zosha Zaks is the manager of education and programs at Towson University's Hussman Center for Adults with Autism. Coming up after the break for the news, we'll continue our focus on the challenges facing adults on the spectrum. I'll talk with the Hussman Center's executive director, Dr. Charlotte Exner, about the evolution of services for autistic adults and the role her center is playing in that change. You're listening to Maryland Morning. I'm Rob Sivak. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning. I'm Rob Sivak. Continuing our focus this morning on efforts to address the needs and challenges of autistic adults in the Baltimore community, I'm joined now by Dr. Charlotte Exner. She's the executive director of the Hussman Center for Adults with Autism that we visited in the first segment. It's part of the Institute for Well-Being within Towson University's College of Health Professions. Dr. Exner, it's a pleasure to be with you. Could you give us a little bit of history about how and why the Hussman Center was established and describe your mission here?
Sure. The Hussman Center came about first as a center for young adults with autism. And that evolved because we had been in, within the College of Health Professions, a number of conversations, including early on with someone very connected to the university, Tim Watkins, who was approaching us saying, what is Towson University doing in the area of working with individuals with autism? We had a very robust mix of disciplines at Towson. But at that time, and at that point it was probably 2006, we were beginning to do more work with children and youth with autism and talk about that within classes and in preparing our students to work with children with autism. But there was more conversation as he had us prodding us to think about, well, what else is out there? And then we had a Towson University alum, Doug Erdman, approach us saying, what is Towson doing in the area of working with adults with autism? And what would you like to be doing? And in that process, he and Therese Erdman, his wife, worked with us in developing a proposal, a plan for a center for young adults with autism, where we would develop some initiatives in support of these young people having something beyond high school and addressing those needs and coupling it with student education.
Mm-hmm. And so that was about 10 years ago.
That occurred in fall 2007. Mm-hmm. So we're now talking almost 9 years ago. At that point, there was very, very little conversation, very little attention to adults with autism. The focus was very heavily on children at that point, mm-hmm. and evolving treatments and interventions for children.
That's very interesting. I mean, what changed the conversation? What, I mean, obviously, if by logical extension, the young children with autism were going to be growing up and, right. and eventually they would be adults. But really across the country, people have been talking about the relative lack of services and lack of programs for adult autistics.
Exactly. And in 2007, there was almost no attention to adults with autism, or at least that's my impression. The interests started to come from parents who had learned to be quite good advocates of their children and then their evolving young adults within the school system, and seeing that services and accommodations for individuals with autism made a difference. They also were looking at the fact that while if they had a neurotypical child, a child without autism, that there were clear pathways that they might follow when they exited high school. They might go into higher education. They might go into work. They might do a transition time period and then move into higher education or a trade school. But that the path for individuals with autism was incredibly ambiguous. Mm-hmm. That there was not an environment, a culture around how to support an individual with autism moving into the adult world with some unique supports that might be very different than an individual, let's say, with Down syndrome. So that while there had been attention to individuals with intellectual disabilities, perhaps physical disabilities, that there had been very little attention to the unique needs and challenges of young adults with autism.
Mm-hmm. And how would you describe those special needs, those unique needs?
I think with individuals with autism, many, many people have incredible capabilities, many talent areas, and yet may have challenges with social communication, with adjusting to changing expectations, changing demands, and yet are very capable of doing a wide variety of work and other kinds of activities that don't need to be so highly structured or limited. They have great capacity, but also need some supports. In particular, let's say around some of the planning needed in activities, some of the social interactions, some of the sensory and environmental challenges that might come into play for an individual with autism.
So, in the mission here at the Hussman Center for adults with autism, is the focus on individualized tracks for working with individuals and finding what their unique capabilities are and then developing them along those lines?
No, our center has always been geared toward creating programs that would be open to individuals with autism, individuals with autism who might be verbal, might be somewhat verbal, might not be verbal but have other methods of communication, who could engage and interact with our university students so that we set up an environment for mutual learning. We thought right from the beginning that it was not only a matter of supporting adults with autism in developing other skills and continuing to learn once they were leaving high school, like so many other people do, but that it was a matter of also educating the community about the capabilities of people with autism and why someone might have a little different behaviors or a different way of learning or need certain accommodations in their environment. So we focused as a university, in our university mode, on how could we support the education of our students while also supporting the adults with autism in having experiences in an inclusive setting.
I'm talking with Dr. Charlotte Exner, the executive director of Towson University's Hussman Center for Adults with Autism, located just north of the campus in the Towson City Center complex. So, getting back to the educational component of the Hussman Center, what is the mix of Towson University students and university health professionals who are working with the autistic adult participants here?
Well, we've evolved and evolved over the years. Currently, the students who are involved in our programs are a mix of both students who are preparing to be professionals, so that we will have speech-language pathologists under the supervision of a speech-language pathology faculty member working with individuals with who are interested in building their communication skills. We might have an occupational therapy faculty member with occupational therapy graduate students working on with an individual around life skills such as cooking, meal planning, shopping, those areas, so that both the students and the individuals with autism are learning some very important skills. But the largest number of students we have are enrolled in a course here at Towson University now that meets what we call a core requirement. One of the essential categories that all undergraduate students have to fulfill prior to completing their baccalaureate degree. And the course that our students are linked in with relates to the category of diversity and helping the students look at disability as diversity. Mm-hmm. And while they're in this course, and that course is taught by our manager of programs and education here at the Hussman Center, the students have the opportunity for 10 weeks to spend about 2 hours a week involved in a particular program here at the Hussman Center. These students come from as many as 30-some different majors within the university. Mm-hmm. They may be a business student, a mass communication student, an art student, biology, education, health profession student from any number of areas. And the goal is for them to have an opportunity to interact as a peer with individuals with autism.
And how many participants from outside the university community, how many private adults are coming to use these programs to benefit from them?
In the past year, 2015-2016, we had about 125 different adults with autism access something through the Hussman Center for Adults with Autism. Mm. Some people enrolled in programs, some people enrolled in or attended our Friday evening social groups, and some people did both.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Dr. Exner, how do you measure the effectiveness of your work here? What about outcomes? Do you get feedback? Do you follow on? Do you know what impact you've had on the lives of the adults with autism who come here?
We have both that anecdotal feedback, and we have systems for gathering more data in a systematic manner. So from the anecdotal side, we have people who say that they love coming here, they repeatedly enroll in programs, they say that we're very unique in creating this opportunity for bringing together how we would refer to our neurotypical students and participants, that they feel very accepted, welcomed, that they feel very comfortable being here. They say that they benefit quite a lot from the programs. We also collect some data from the participants themselves, because we focus a lot on self-determination, adults with autism making choices, making decisions that relate to their own goals. We talk with our participants about their goals. They tell us how, what specific goals they want to work on. We support them in looking at how they're making progress toward that goal. So we help them document the progress they're making, and we also identify some of the progress that individuals are making as well.
Mm-hmm. And how would you rate the impact?
I think that our participants gain quite a lot of skills and confidence in interacting across a variety of situations. We support them in developing self-expression as well as self-advocacy. And most would, on our satisfaction surveys, report that they very definitely have outcomes in those areas.
Yeah. Thank you. Dr. Charlotte Exner is the executive director of the Hussman Center for Adults with Autism, part of the Institute for Well-Being within Towson University's College of Health Professions. We have links to more information about the Hussman Center, as well as to Itinerus, the nonprofit group we mentioned in the first segment, and to other important resources for autistic adults on our website at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Rob Sivak. Stay with us.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us pretty much every Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. For her review this week, she's been to the Fells Point Corner Theater, where she's checked out the Theatrical Mining Company's production of a new play called Crash and Burn, PA.
Now in its 35th year, the Baltimore Playwrights Festival has been going through structural and organizational changes. The summer season consists almost entirely of script-in-hand staged readings, which continue into September. The only full production is Crash and Burn, PA, written by festival veteran Robert R. Bowie Jr. and produced by the Theatrical Mining Company. Bowie is a lawyer, and like several of his previous plays, Crash and Burn is set in the legal world. But unlike some of those earlier plays, which tackled subjects ranging from slavery to repressed memory, Crash and Burn is a farce. A farce that takes place in the office of a pair of bottom-feeding lawyers. Mark Crash is a low-level criminal attorney. His partner, Mike Byrne, apparently prefers dead clients. He specializes in wills. Mr. Crash's latest client is a businessman with uncharacteristically deep pockets. In one of several exposition-laden passages, Penny Nichols, as Crash and Byrne's jaded secretary, begins describing this high-profile client to the new cleaning lady, Brenda. But Jessica Taylor's bright, perky Brenda knows more about this notorious tycoon than the secretary does.
Crash has got this one big client, Mr. Yanair, who he's going to court with this morning, and he's going to get paid loads of money by the guy today.
Wow, is that the international businessman? The guy in all the headlines? He's supposed to be the richest man in America?
Has he been in the Inquirer?
He made billions on mortgage-backed securities that caused the Wall Street crash. Millions of people lost their homes and pension funds because of him and his cronies.
Brenda turns out to have a strong stake in this case and in Crash and Burn. She also turns out to be smarter than anyone else in the play, one of several swipes the playwright takes at the legal profession. Crash's client, whose full name is Milty Bill Yanair, is charged with defrauding a bank. Two things about him don't make sense to Brenda or to the audience. Why does he insist that Crash tour the bank's vault? And especially, why would a wealthy businessman hire sleazy Mark Crash? The answers take up most of the play. Along the way, there's plenty of farce-style confusion. A pair of identical coats and identical briefcases, slamming doors, a missing safe deposit box, and a stolen Porsche. These mishaps reduce both law partners to sniveling wimps. Not a big change for Tom Pissin's nervous, nerdy Mr. Byrne, but a considerable decline for cocky Mr. Crash, played by Jonathan Ingebrigtsen, for some reason, as a caricature of a mafioso.
Oh, God, he's coming up here. I know he is. 102 miles an hour in a stolen car.
Okay. I apologize to my parents for being born. I apologize to my wife and daughter whom I abandoned at birth. Oh, God, on bended knee, to everybody.
A stolen Porsche, even. Oh, God, who am I? When did my life go wrong?
And it was my fault. Everything.
Slapstick and slamming doors aren't all that playwright Bowie is going for here. Besides skewering the practice of law, he takes aim at political and financial targets, particularly rich businessmen buying politicians. Earnest and topical as all of this may be, at times it feels forced. Farce may appear to be freewheeling, but it's actually a delicate piece of theatrical machinery, very tricky to pull off. Director Barry Feinstein, whose forte tends to be plays of a more serious nature, hasn't found the ideal balance between Crash and Burn's thematic underpinnings and its comic hijinks, a fault I suspect lies primarily in the script. Crash and Burn doesn't quite end up in ashes, but as a farcical take on the current state of American legal, financial, and political affairs, it just can't compete with the real thing.
Crash and Burn PA is at the Fells Point Corner Theater through Sunday. It's a production of the Theatrical Mining Company, and it's part of the 35th anniversary season of the Baltimore Playwrights Festival. The festival continues into next month. We've got a link to all the details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Jay Wynn Russick will be back again next week with a review of the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's outdoor production of Julius Caesar. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to take a break for news, and when we come back, I'll be joined by Suzanne Feldman, an author from Frederick who has published a terrific debut novel. It's called Absalom's Daughters. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. My next guest is the Frederick-based author Suzanne Feldman. Her debut novel is a gem. It's called Absalom's Daughters. It's set in the Deep South in the 1950s, and it chronicles the adventures of two teenage girls, sisters, one black, one white, both abandoned by their father. They set out on a road trip to find him and to find themselves. And Suzanne Feldman finds herself here in the studio with me. Good morning. It's good to meet you.
Good morning. It's good to meet you, too.
So let's start by having you introduce Cassie and Judith, these two fascinating young girls who are the protagonists of your novel.
Okay. Well, Cassie is the daughter of a laundress and the granddaughter of a laundress. And they live in a little town called Heron Neck, Mississippi. Heron Neck is very small and very poor. And the two girls, Judith is also very poor. She grows up on the other side of the railroad tracks with her parents. Her father is an oil man, and her father is also Cassie's father. He's a philanderer. And so the two girls find out that they're half-sisters. The father finds out that he's got a fortune waiting for him in Virginia, a family fortune inheritance. And he takes off to find it, abandoning his white family and, for what it's worth, his black family. And the two girls decide that they're going to get their due. They can't just let this go. And they go after him with basically a junky car and a ham and a little bit of money and a shoe. And they go on their road trip.
Yeah, and they're like 16 years old when this happens.
Basically, yes.
And Judith wants to be a radio star, as
a
she
radio
says
star,
in,
yeah.
the, in the book. She wants to find her fortune in New York. Mm-hmm. And Cassie is actually encouraged by someone in her family to leave. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, her mother, should I give away the plot?
Well, just, we want to give a little taste of it, that Cassie, who is the black character of,
right.
of the two of them, you know, is not stopped, shall we say, by her mom when it comes to taking off on this adventure for all sorts of reasons that you deal with a little later in the book. I mean, the title of the book is Absalom's Daughters,
mm-hmm.
and I understand that this is inspired by the famous Faulkner novel, Absalom, Absalom. So in what way is it related to the Faulkner masterpiece?
Well, Faulkner in Absalom, Absalom wrote a story about a white man who wanted to establish a dynasty in the Deep South, and he did all sorts of things to do this. But one thing that dogged him throughout his desire was one drop of black blood in his family. And the whole book is sort of devoted to finding that black drop of blood, which ruins everything for him. So in that book, the women are basically wallpaper, and the African-American characters are even less than that. They're just background characters. And what I wanted to do was to read about their lives, you know, instead of just Colonel Sutphen's life, the main character in Absalom, Absalom. So I wrote the story that I wanted to read about the great-great-granddaughters, or maybe they're the great-great-great-granddaughters of this particular family. And Cassie and Judith are named for the two daughters of Colonel Sutphen, one black, one white. In Absalom, Absalom.
Yeah, there's a guy named George Sissel who's on the faculty at MICA, and you're actually a MICA graduate from way back before George joined the faculty there. He's just retired, actually, but he, for a while, was the director of the Contemporary Museum here in Baltimore, and he had a great show years ago called Mining the Museum, and he would have these paintings, and he would highlight the insignificant characters in the painting.
Nice.
And draw your eye to, you know, the slave walking across the field instead of the grand, you know, master who is the subject of the painting. And it helped us orient our thinking and our looking in a totally different way. And that's really what this book ends up doing. Yeah.
It focuses on the descendants of the minor characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You are also a science fiction writer. This is your first novel that you've published with your own name.
Yes.
Suzanne Feldman.
Yes.
You publish under the name Severna Park, which I just love, and many of our listeners will get that. Does your science fiction writing inform your non-science fiction novel writing at all?
Well, I guess there's a little bit of magic realism in the novel Absalom's Daughters that could be conceivably informed by science fiction.
Yeah, there's a mule who may or may not talk. You
right.
know, there's magic potions. You know, occasionally.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are no aliens jumping out of people's chests.
Is that what happens in your science fiction novels?
No, that's been done.
Yeah, it has been done. I've heard about that. Because it is this notion of magical realism and the way it intertwines with people's understanding of race.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this notion of one drop of black blood. I'm always fascinated by, like, there's a television commercial for Ancestry.com, and
mm-hmm.
this woman says, I found I'm 26% Native American. Well, how do you come up with that
right.
percentage? That's just, it's silly.
Yeah.
And you've given a lot of thought to the notion of race and the notion of what it means to be black, what it means to be white.
Well, as a fiction writer, it's all made up, and I do write from a position of white privilege. So I can't say that I mean, I have thought a lot about you know, these black characters, but they are fictional characters. They're not based on reality. They're based on research. And the research that I did was Zora Neale Hurston, William Faulkner.
I mean, so you read other novels.
Yes,
it's not like you researched in any. Is Heron Neck, Mississippi, a real place?
Oh no, yeah. I made that up.
So right, so you just made up this whole thing, and it's informed by the stories. You know, some of these famous stories.
Yes,
Zora Neale Hurston and
Toni Morrison, yeah. And Faulkner and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who's a huge influence on my work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, your understanding of race obviously is a big factor in how you're going to write characters like Cassie and her family. And there are a lot of particularly wonderfully strong women in particular in this book, not only the two main characters, but people in their orbit. Was that also purposeful?
Yes, I wanted to make sure that women were the strong characters, because there are so many books, and especially in Faulkner, where the women characters are just, you know, they're just there. They're just sort of puffs of dust. And I wanted to make sure that the women had some, you know, a little bit more body than that, a little bit more oomph.
Yeah. And the way that Judith, as a young white teenager, negotiates this trip with Cassie, who is clearly not white, she's mm-hmm. African American. You bring up, you know, obviously all of the barriers and the challenges that they faced with two people of different races
in the Jim Crow South.
In the Jim Crow South, yes. In the 1950s, is that particular time period? Is the Eisenhower administration?
Right. I mean,
what was the appeal of that particular time setting?
Well, it was when the interstate highways were built. So they could get a little bit further, a little bit faster. That was one thing. The 1950s were a point of big transition. Schools were integrated in the 1950s, 1955, in fact, in Arkansas, of all places. And the 1950s are, you know, it's sort of a watershed decade in racial relations, I think.
Yeah, because it really, you pose some very poignant questions or provocative ideas about the notion of, would African-Americans want to be white given mm-hmm. the choice? Can white kids like Judith, who is a singer, can they sing with the same kind of emotional connection, gospel music, for example, that African-Americans do? You know, what can we cross over, as it were?
Right. There's a lot of experimentation in that book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a terrific read, and I really appreciate your writing it and coming by and talking about it. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
The Frederick-based author, Suzanne Feldman, her debut novel is called Absalom's Daughter. She'll be talking about her book tomorrow morning at Curious Iguana, the bookstore on North Market Street in downtown Frederick. It's part of their Tuesdays with Tea book club series, and it starts at 11 o'clock. We've got a link to information on our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Wednesday, more with Baltimore's Neighbors to the West. Our Focus on the County series continues with Jan Gardner, the county executive of Frederick County. Hope you join us Wednesday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.